two important remarks concerning rabbinic laws. How should we look at rabbinic law? Should we say that the Jewish legal system has two tiers, two levels, two different sources of authority? One is biblical, coming from God, from revelation, divine law. And then there is human supplementation, coming from certain bodies with legal authority, like Sanhedrin, which created laws in addition. So you have two tiers of law with two different sources of legal authority. There is a minority of scholars who hold this view. Some of the evidence that they point to in favor of this view is that the penalty for violating rabbinic law is not equal to the penalty for violating a biblical law. It's less. So, it seems that there must be some radical difference between the two categories. Secondly, if one is obligated to fulfill a particular law and tries to do so and is in doubt as to whether he succeeded, if the law is biblical, he's got to go back and do it again. They don't tolerate a doubtful performance. If the law is rabbinic, then he doesn't have to go back and do it again. We allow him to get away with it, even though he's not sure that he fulfilled it. So we treat the rabbinic laws. Oh, there's a third example. Let's suppose that we're in a situation where there's a conflict. There's a conflict between a biblical law and a rabbinic law. We cannot do both. In almost all cases, the biblical law takes precedence. So here are three respects in which we treat the biblical law more stringently than the rabbinic law. This minority of scholars say that you have evidence here that there are really two different sources of authority, one superior to the other. That's why we treat the one more stringently than the other. The majority disagree, and Ramchal goes with the majority, that all the laws have biblical force. They all have a biblical force. Even those which were invented by human legal authorities have biblical force. The simple analogy here is if the king appoints a governor of your province, and in the letter of appointment he gives him the authority to create laws, and the governor does so, and the citizen violates one of the governor's laws, he can be accused of treason to the king. And if he protests, what do you mean? I didn't disobey one of the king's laws, I only disobeyed the law of the governor. It will be pointed out to him that it's the king that gave the governor authority to make laws. So by violating the governor's law, you are implicitly violating the king's law. Similarly, the Torah gives the Sanhedrin the authority to make laws. That's 100% true. If I have time, I'll modify it. I'm just inserting that for the record. But roughly speaking, the Torah gives, the Bible gives the Sanhedrin the authority to make laws. If the human beings in the Sanhedrin make a law and a person violates it, he has implicitly violated the biblical law which says that the Sanhedrin has the authority to make laws. So, the laws are all taken to be having biblical force. If so, what happens to the three items we mentioned where the rabbinic laws are treated with less stringency than biblical laws? What happens to the evidence for the minority? Does anybody know the answer to this question?
It's a matter of hierarchy. That the king's law would still take precedence over the governor's law if the two were in conflict.
That's still saying it's two tiers.
It's two tiers, but each one has two tiers in terms of authority. That's okay. You could solve it without that, but you could solve it without that. If the letter of the king appointing the governor says that the governor has authority to make laws, and his laws are all limited by their application, that they should contradict any of the king's other laws. If that is stated in the letter of appointment, then I agree with you. But suppose it's not stated in the letter of appointment. Now, I'm a citizen. The governor said to do X, which has the king's authority backing it, and the king, in another place, said to do Y. And I can't do both. Seems to me I'm confronted by two laws of the king. True, one goes through the government, governor, and the other one doesn't. But so what? To me, it's two king's laws. And it's not obvious to me which takes precedence. So now, but using your idea, you can use the same idea to put it from the top down, you can use it from the bottom up. How?
Well, shouldn't the king's law take precedence because of the fact that if you have to go up to question the authority of it, you can go straight up to the king on one respect, rather than going to the governor and then to the king.
Seems to me that if the king appoints the governor
right.
and gives him the authority to make the laws, then unless he himself explicitly states that there is a hierarchy.
But aren't you assuming, though, that the governor is making laws perfectly justly in line with what the king would want?
I don't know if you have to assume that. Let me give you an analogy for American law.
Would you have found this?
Yeah, but look at it this way. You have the legislature. The legislature of the United States originally adopted a constitution. That constitution set up three branches of government. Those three branches of government are pretty independent in terms of the constitution. We have had higher crises. Those of you old enough to remember old R.M., Richard Milhouse Nixon, who refused to turn over his tapes on the grounds that the judicial branch has no right to tell the executive branch what to do. Separation of powers means that each one should be independent. Now, the same crisis could arise between the legislative branch and the executive branch, or the legislative branch and the judicial branch. The judicial branch can declare laws passed by the legislature as unconstitutional. No one says, listen, the Constitution was originally passed by the legislature. So surely no one can challenge the legislature, because that's the source from which the Constitution came. No one says that. One looks at the content of the Constitution. If the Constitution doesn't say that one branch takes precedence over the other branch, then they are really more or less equal, and a crisis between the two of them is not settled by the way the law is structured. So here, the fact that it's the king that sets up the governor's authority doesn't automatically mean that the governor's laws are less important than other of the king's laws. This itself is one of the king's laws. And I will show you an example of that in Torah law in a moment, in the session. The solution that is correct is that the same answer that he gave is used from the bottom up. Namely, that the rabbis wrote these leniencies into their laws. When they created these laws, they created them with the leniencies written in. They said, we want you to do X, but if you try to do X and you're not certain whether you succeeded or not, don't bother and do it again. We want you to do X, but if X contradicts a law coming from God directly, we don't want you to do X. What was the third one? The penalties. They created the penalties. They created, typically, lesser penalties for their laws than the laws that come directly from God. But they didn't have to do this. They didn't have to do this. I'll give you an example of how they can take advantage of leverage which the Torah gives them, even by way of creating laws that contradict other laws from God. This is built into the system. He mentions this at the end of the article. The Torah says, on Rosh Hashanah, you should blow a horn. Every year. Biblical commandments. The rabbi said, don't. The rabbis created a law telling you not to do a biblical law. In direct contradiction to the biblical law. How could he do that?
Well, because of the historical situation at the time, because the chauffeur was being killed.
That's great. That's motivation. I'm talking about the legal authority to do it. There are lots of things which you might be motivated to do, but don't have the legal authority to do
it. Well, isn't it better to, if you carry the chauffeur, or if you get seen in public carrying the chauffeur, and some European guard or whatever it is sees you and says, oh, you're carrying the chauffeur, I'm going to kill you, you're not going to be able to serve as shaman.
Yeah.
So wouldn't it be better to be able to continue your...
But there you're talking about a biblical restriction that's written in. You don't have to risk your life to carry the chauffeur.
Uh-huh.
No, the problem there was that they might carry it in public domain and violate another biblical law.
Right.
But you can talk about the motivation for making a law. That's all fine and good. But that doesn't mean that the law is valid just because there's motivation. It means the legal authority to do it. Let's suppose that the United States needs some new legislation in July. Well, it can't have it! Because the legislation on vacation. They're in Hawaii and they're in Alaska and they're skiing the Alps. And they'll be back in November. And you just have to wait from July to November. And you got all the motivation in the world. But without the legislation there to pass it, it's not a law. Now I'm asking, how can the rabbis, what legal authority do they have to tell you not to fulfill a biblical law? This ought to be analogous to the thought that if God says to blow the shofar, and God says the Sanhedrin can make laws, but that's only people, that's a two-stage process, then they don't have the authority to tell you not to do what God told you to do. And they do it in a number of occasions. There are places where the Torah itself says to do X, the rabbis say don't do X, and the practice is not to do X. I have to explain why that is, but Rav Hanavasma has a beautiful explanation. Yeah.
I suppose that the rabbis are the ones that are teaching us the Torah, and also, I suppose they know what's best for the current situation, and don't they have the authority to do that?
This is a very fascinating and interesting idea. In another essay, Rav Hanavasma mentions this idea to solve a different problem. How are children obligated to do anything that the rabbis say if the children are not obligated in any biblical laws, because they're minors, and if the rabbis get their authority from the biblical law, which the children are not obligated to obey, so then how are the children ever caught by any rabbinical law? And we do regard them as obligated. And Rav Hanan again says in another essay, something like you're saying, it's not that there's a formal legal structure. The biblical law says that the rabbis have law, and the rabbis have a law, and therefore it applies. It's rather that the rabbis tell us what the Torah wants from us. They, through the Torah, understand best what God wants of us, and that in itself gives them another kind of authority. But this is a very interesting speculative idea, and it is used by Rav Chaim, but... there's a narrower and more direct idea that can be used to explain the question of shofar and shabbos. Yeah.
So, based on what you're saying, would it be hypothetically possible for the rabbis to institute laws allowing violating shabbos or breaking other...
Okay, I didn't give the explanation yet, so you're right to ask, but you're one step ahead of me. The answer to your question is no, but you don't understand why. I'll explain to you. Let me give you the explanation, then you'll see why.
All right.
So, how does it work? First of all, the rabbis are allowed to make laws that will contradict biblical laws. They're allowed to do so. Question is, so what? So they made it. Should they follow it? What status does it have? What legal authority does it have? So Rav Chaim says like this. Let's imagine a case, forgetting the rabbis for a moment, let's imagine a case where two positive commandments apply to me, and one can be satisfied only actively, and the other can be satisfied passively. So my choices are actively satisfy A and therefore actively violate B, or passively satisfy B and therefore passively violate A. Those are my choices. When you have a conflict between two positive commandments of that kind, the super rule, the meta rule is be passive, so that the violation of the one commandment is only passive. Don't do it actively, do it passively. That's the super rule, the meta rule. Okay. Now here's what the rabbis do. The rabbis say, the Torah says to blow shofar.
Now we're going to make a rabbinic law not to blow shofar. Now, the citizen has a cousin. He has a cousin between the positive mitzvah to blow shofar and the positive mitzvah to obey the rabbis. So that's a conflict between two positive mitzvahs. What does the super rule say? The super rule says we have a conflict between two positive mitzvahs of that kind. Perform the passive one and violate the other one only passively. So as long as the rabbi's law is don't do X, they win. They win because they're inserting themselves into a legal structure that gives them the leverage to win under these conditions. Again, if I have any two positive commandments, A and B, A says do something, B says don't do something, and now I'm in a situation where I can't satisfy both. So my choices are, do what A says and actively therefore violate B, or on the other hand, satisfy B passively and therefore violate A passively. Those are my two choices. The super rule, the meta rule says, take the latter choice. Be passive, satisfy the one that requires passivity, and you'll be thereby violating the other one passively. That's what you do when you have the meta rule, which governs how you resolve the conflict. Okay, now here, the Torah said, blow shofar. The rabbis first created a law, don't blow shofar. They're allowed to do that. Okay, but having done it, I have to ask myself, what should I do? I have a conflict between a biblical law and a rabbinic law. How do I adjudicate that conflict? So, in this particular case, where the biblical law said, do something, blow shofar, and the rabbinic law said, don't do something, be passive. So then, I have a biblical law to blow the shofar. I have a biblical positive law to do what the rabbis say. Now I have a conflict between these two biblical laws. The rule is, be passive. Since the rabbi's law was to be passive, they win. But, what would happen if we're the other way around? What would happen if the biblical law were a passive law? You satisfy the biblical law passively. And let's suppose the rabbis pass an active law to do something positively. Then the same meta rule tells me not to do what the rabbis say. In other words, the system is set up in such a way that the rabbis have a certain amount of leverage. Now, we read it this way. God set up all the laws. He set up the law of giving the rabbis authority. That law has a certain place in the legal structure, which means that in conflict it can have a certain amount of leverage, not total, but partial. By giving them the authority in this particular way, he was inviting them, making available to them that leverage to cancel out the performance of certain biblical laws when they felt it was necessary. At no point in the whole discussion does someone say, but look, this one comes directly from God, and this is only indirect, so indirect is surely secondary to direct. No, that doesn't come up. So this idea that the governor's laws are automatically going to be less authority than the king's laws, I don't think it's true in logic, and it's certainly not true in Jewish jurisprudence.
Yeah. Do the rabbis, when you have two, let's say for example, you have a biblical law and you have a rabbinic law, and they're both active, let's say, for example. They were saying you pick the biblical one to do. But we said that was only because that the rabbis chose that as part of the structure of the law. I mean, are there any examples where they didn't choose that as part of the structure of the law?
Okay, and it gets complicated. I'm just giving this as an example. Now, let's go back to what he asked. Let's suppose the rabbis pass a law to actively violate a negative prohibition. So then it's all over. They can't do that. They don't have the leverage to do that. That's why, according to almost everybody, there are a few places in Texas which go further, but everybody else says that they don't have the leverage to create an active violation of other Torah laws. So this idea that, you move 25 miles away from the synagogue, it's hard to get there on Saturdays, so let's see, it's a question of praying in the synagogue and paying your dues, versus staying home and perhaps not paying your dues. So I think you should come to the synagogue and drive your car for sure, because it's more important than the Sabbath. No, that's out. It's not only out for that reason, it's out because probably the Sabbath laws is one of the 10 pronouncements at Sinai, and it's a potentially capital crime, and praying in the synagogue is only a rabbinic recommendation. So in legal terms, the idea of a conflict here is just fantasy. It's the merest fantasy. There's no legal conflict here at all. Shabbos takes precedence over praying in the synagogue anytime. Okay, I want to get one more point.
Yeah.
Honestly, rabbis should be very sensitive when introducing rabbinic laws, especially when there are biblical laws.
Correct.
Could you define the requirements?
Okay, it's hard to define. The key requirement is that it must be publicized. It must be very clear, the demarcation between what is biblical and what is rabbinic. That's an absolute requirement, and sometimes there are discussions about particular laws where it wasn't, historically it's been lost exactly what the demarcation is. But in general, there's too much to do. There's one more point that I must get to.
The authorities for the rabbis to make new laws would be considered an active authority. It would be an active doing for them to do, whereas doesn't the Torah also say you shouldn't add or subtract from the laws, which would be passive? So is there a conflict in that conflict inherent in itself and the rabbis creating the laws itself?
Okay, so obviously if the same book says that the rabbis have the authority to make the laws and it says not to add or subtract from the laws, it has to be a way of understanding how those statements are consistent. The standard explanation is that when it says don't add or subtract the laws, exactly what we said a moment ago, don't add or subtract to or from the laws that God gave. Don't misportray the Torah as containing an extra law or minus a law that the Torah portrays. But if it's clearly labeled as a rabbinic law, then it's no problem. Yeah?
Well, what happens if a rabbi creates a passive law that counteracts with another passive rabbinic law?
Well, first of all, two rabbinic laws contradicting one another are not a problem now. The authority is the same. And either it'll just be a contradiction, which will mean that it's absurd to do.
Right.
He has to repeal the original law in order to. I also understand how you could have two passive laws that conflict. This one says stay in bed, that one says stay in bed. So I'm staying in bed.
Well,
how could I possibly.
One passively says stay in bed, one passively says get out of bed.
That's not passive. My vocabulary. Get out of bed is not passive.
Okay.
But if it said you shouldn't stay in bed, then it would be directly contradictory.
Right. See, you can have a negative law that's active. The difference between positive and negative, and the difference between active and passive, are not the same. It's a cross-cutting classification. That's all the sources talk about. Okay, now, Ramchal asks a final question, which I told you often, I've not seen asked anywhere else, and the answer that he gives is really, in a certain sense, astounding. He says, if the rabbinic laws all have biblical status, why didn't God give them? They're all going to end up being God's will. They're going to be treated as God's will. They're going to express God's will. So why didn't God give them originally? Why did he wait for the rabbis to end? Now, here's the wrong answer. I'll tell you the answer. You tell me why it's wrong. The wrong answer is that some of these laws depend upon specific historical conditions. When things developed in such a way, it became necessary to institute a practice of this and this kind. The holiday of Purim is a reflection of the events of the time of Purim. Surely you couldn't have had such a holiday beforehand. The requirement of not blowing the shofar on Rosh Hashanah because that was Shabbos is because at a certain time, adherence to the Shabbos was in danger for whatever reason, and they wanted to stress it. They wanted to protect people against the possible inadvertent carrying of the shofar in public domain. So they said that's more important than blowing the shofar. But it wasn't always that way. So that's why they had to wait for the rabbis to arrive at those new historical conditions and make the new rule. That's an inadequate reason. It's an incorrect reason. Why? Right. God certainly knew that those future conditions would take place, and therefore, finish it up.
Therefore, he would just implement them in the beginning.
Yep.
When those things occur, then just...
God can write a law which says, when circumstances are such and such, then these are the things to do. They don't have to wait for the circumstances to occur. Indeed, we have laws like that. We have specific statements of what to do when the Jewish people go into exile, which were written by God in the Torah itself, and which only took place 1,000 years later. So this can't be the reason. It wasn't given by God because we have to wait for later circumstances. We always write it with trigger conditions, which would meet the later circumstances and then be usable in that way. So what is the right answer? Hal says the right answer is that God wanted part of the Torah to be brought into existence through human beings. I must tell you, when I first read that, I almost fell off my chair. In the normal context of Jewish ideas, this is a shocking statement. We are told that the Torah is the blueprint of creation. God looked at the Torah and created everything to match what's in it. You mean the blueprint was incomplete, and we had to sort of complete it as it goes along? The Torah is God's will. Our job is to fulfill it. That's hard enough. That requires enough ingenuity and creativity and self-development, self-control. We're all supposed to be charged with creating Torah? To me, it sounded like it was a mixture of levels in existence that was very surprising. But then I began to meditate on it and ask myself, where else do we have similar authority? Where else do we have similar capacity? Let's take the categories of holiness, things that are holy. Can the Jewish people create new holy things? Can we invent new holy things? Well, let's see. Sacrifices. The items that are sacrificed are holy. How do they become holy? Because the Jew says, you're holy. Behold, you're a sacrifice. And bang, the cow or the sheep or the goat or the wine or the oil or the flour or whatever it is becomes holy. Because he said so. Let's take the temple. The temple was inaugurated with a certain human performance. The temple grounds are controlled by the human prerogative. The temple could be expanded. Jerusalem, which has a certain sanctity, can be expanded. The sanctity of the land of Israel can be expanded by certain human activities. So those categories can be expanded, can be added to. Now let's push up the ladder. What about converts? When the Jewish people accepts a convert, a new quality of soul comes into being. That is really quite striking, if you think of it in those terms. God gave us the ability to add to the quantity of Jewish soul in the world, or the number of Jewish soul in the world. I don't know why I wasn't shocked by that when I first heard it. Just took it for granted, because it's so obvious. Now let's push into the category of law, at least a little bit. What is a vow? A vow is a mitzvah where a Jew can say, for me, apples are just as bad as pork. Then apples become just as bad as pork for him. In certain respect, maybe even worse. Just because he said so. They're not bad for anybody else, but they're bad for him. Or to undertake a particular obligation as an oath. These are two different concepts in Jewish law. Where a person takes an oath to recite 23 psalms a day, or to give a certain amount of money to charity, or whatever it is. And when he takes that oath, it becomes a biblical commandment for him. So within vows and oaths, you have a biblical rubric whereby a person can create new biblical commandments for himself. Given all this background, maybe it's a little less shocking that by the rabbis creating new laws, they are creating Torah. They're creating Torah. This gives what to me is a very dramatic application of the classical idea that we are partners with God in the creation of the universe. That's usually explained that God made everything with all of its potentials, and he set the goal for the universe, and he gave us the rules by which the universe can be guided to fulfill its potential, and then it's up to us. That's good enough. That's quite a job. Enabling the universe to fulfill its godly potential. But now we are given a hand in cooperating with God in defining the godly potential. That's really very striking. But as I say, it goes hand in hand, I think, with all these other categories of holiness that we do have some access to. Yes.
I haven't done the answer why, though. Like, why would he give us that?
Did I ask why?
So, why didn't God give them?
Oh, I see what you mean. Very good. This first answer to why was he didn't do it because it's impossible. And I disqualified that answer.
Right.
Okay. So now what I'm saying is I say a little bit. Why are you typing at that computer? Because I'm writing a letter. Is that a relevant answer? I'm not doing my economics homework, and I'm not balancing my bank books, and I'm not searching the internet. I'm writing a letter. That's an answer. Of course, you may also want to know why I'm writing a letter. Look, very good. You know, we can push the questions as far as you like. Here, I can explain the immediate intention in allowing human beings to create part of Torah. That is to say, allowing in not giving the rabbinical laws of Sinai. Right? It's not of necessity, because the conditions haven't occurred. It's because God wants people to have a hand in creating Torah. I can then associate it with having a hand in creating all these other categories. If you ask why he wanted that, that's a further question, and indeed, I may not have much to say about it. But it's not as if we hadn't said anything. Yeah.
That's just in the response to the why. Couldn't that be a very smart technique for sustaining the Jewish people? I'm actually thinking about my organization at home, and when we want to involve people, we have them take part in making things in our organization. That's the only way people adhere to it and remain conscious of our efforts and of our mentality of our doing, by taking an active part in the process.
That's your organization embraces about how many people?
What's that?
Your organization includes about how many people?
Maybe 40 at a meeting and 400 on the line.
Okay, now suppose I decided to apply this strategy to your organization by allowing 2 out of the 40 to actively participate in making things happen. Would the strategy be successful for those conditions?
I suppose it depends how much faith people had in the leaders.
But this strategy of involving people in creating how the organization runs would not be successful if it was only 2 out of 40. Then you need some other motivation or strategy. This strategy you're talking about is where the vast majority feel they have a hand. You have subcommittees, and each subcommittee makes its decisions of certain types of strategy or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, the only ones that are qualified here, maybe it's time to insert that qualification. The only ones that are qualified here by the simple law is the Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin is 0.00001% of the population. So to recognize rabbinic laws as a category is not going to be a good motivator if only 0.0001% of the population is involved and everybody else just follows them. Following? It's too small a percentage of the population for people to feel that they have a hand in making the organization run. I don't think it's practical in that way. Yeah.
Is there a parallel to the idea of holding back some Torah from the man to create, is it parallel to the idea of the tzimtzum in the creation of the world itself?
It's certainly an outcome of it, but the purpose of tzimtzum, we spoke about this a couple of days ago, is a different purpose. The purpose of tzimtzum is that the world should be intelligible to human beings. That shouldn't be an infinite black box out of which things come with no reason, rhyme or reason. So God intentionally reduced his activity to the point where he allows categories that human beings can understand. That's not necessary. This aspect of the role, some law should come to the rabbis is not necessary. I think, just to expand a little bit, I'm not going behind it, but just expanding it, this gives you a picture of the grandeur of the human being. That in a certain respect, the human being is on a par with the Creator in this regard. That he can create laws that become divine will. I mean, when you say the words in philosophical terms, it's almost astonishing. A human decision becomes divine will. That's a very radical idea. That's what the Ramchal is saying at the end of it.
Okay.